My passion has always been trying to build a bridge between the personal and the political, between the psychological and the strategic, if you like. So it's a particular pleasure for me to be here talking to people from a background in psychology or psychotherapy. It would help me just to know who I'm talking to. If you could raise your hands and tell me whether you classify yourself as a psychotherapist. Thank you. As a psychologist. Thank you. As a psychiatrist. That's interesting. As a counsellor. Great. And people otherwise in the helping professions. Anybody who hasn't? Great. Thank you very much. What I'm going to do is put up a PowerPoint. Now, I loathe PowerPoints, but I've got some diagrams on it that are fairly important in understanding the cycle of violence. So the PowerPoint will be up there, but don't worry about trying to take notes or copy the diagrams, because we can circulate the PowerPoint to anybody who wants it. I'd much rather have your listening attention. So let's just see. We're not moving quite yet. Ah, here we go. So I think the questions that I'd like to look at with you today are that 40% or possibly even more than that of peace agreements fail, leading to a resumption of conflict within 10 years. Secondly, if we look at why this is, between 2000 and 2005, only 4 conflicts ended in military victory. The other 17 ended in negotiated settlements. Now, this is a big change from the 1990s. In the 1990s, there were, if I'm not mistaken, 23 conflicts ending in military victory and only 22 ending in negotiated settlements. So what we're witnessing is a move gradually towards talking rather than fighting to resolve conflicts. So if we want to know what this means and how we ourselves can help with this transformation, because many people who are in the helping professions feel a tremendous drive to offer their skills to conflict situations, wherever they are. So we need to look at why peace agreements fail. One is that they're often imposed from the top down. And that's one of the reasons why I started Peace Direct, because Peace Direct works from the bottom up, and we'll come back to that. Secondly, because civil society often is not consulted and brought into the process. Thirdly, because the wounds of war have not been healed. And of course, all these points apply whether we're working at the family level, the individual level, the community level, or the international conflict level. And thirdly, because the cycle of violence, if it isn't interrupted, goes round again. So this is the diagram I've made, and you may be able to improve on it, of the cycle of violence. First of all, there's an abuse or an atrocity. The result of that is shock, first of all, then terror, then numbness, then grief, then humiliation, not necessarily in this order, and then anger. And unless an anger and those other emotions are engaged, then anger turns to hatred, hatred turns to bitterness, bitterness turns to retaliation, then you have revenge, and then you have another abuse or atrocity. So what we've discovered, and this is mainly through working with Peace Direct, which Tony mentioned is what I've been doing for the last 12 or 13 years, but it also actually applies to the nuclear situation. But the question is, how can effective interventions be made at these earlier stages? And obviously, the earlier the better. So there are four different ways that I've been able to ascertain that the cycle of violence can be turned around. First of all, by building physical security, then by building political security, then by building psychological security, and lastly, by working at a spiritual level. And I suppose the last two are really why we're in this room together today. I just want to interrupt myself here and say that one of the best things that happened in my life sounds a bit odd, because I got a serious brain disease when I was 30 called encephalitis, and I was in a coma for 10 days. And when I came out of it, the consultant said, well, you've lost about a third of your brain cells. And he said they didn't regenerate. I don't know really whether they do or not. You probably know. And I started to cry. And in those days, he was of such an ilk that he looked at me and he said, why are you crying? And I couldn't say anything. And he said, you've got a pretty face and a nice husband. You'll be all right. And I was 30 at the time. And I was in for 6 years of very severe headaches. Severe headaches so bad that if a motorcycle went past in the road, I'd put my hands over my ears. But the key thing was that as the fog descended on my brain, it felt like being in a fog from about here. And all I could really do was the shopping or looking after my daughter. But there was one thought that went round in my head, and that was, who am I? Who am I? And in 1974, not many people were really allowed asking that question, or not many that I knew. So I found my way by a tortuous path of trying all sorts of terrifying group experiences to eventually to 6 years of Jungian analysis, for which I'm profoundly grateful. And it put me in touch with people working in Gestalt and many other disciplines, all of which I've come to respect greatly. Understanding of the value of the inner while working on the outer has been of key importance to me all the way through. To the extent that now, when I'm working with young social entrepreneurs from all over the world who come for training, I put as much emphasis with them on self-knowledge and self-awareness and getting them working on their own motivations as I do on equipping them with all the other skills that they need. And we can talk about this more, but I'm profoundly convinced that a lot of people who set out to save the world, like me, are driven so strongly by fear and anger, and maybe other emotions as well, unless they deal with them inside, they cause chaos in the organizations they work for. Because if you blurt out your anger on your colleagues, it often takes years of the energy that should be going into your work pouring into internal feuds and so on. A lot of people are nodding, so I guess this must be right. So I reckon that the inner work is absolutely as important as the outer work, and I don't think anybody should be working in world-changing efforts, whether they're local, community-wide or national, without the inner training. So that's why these last two are so important to me. Now I've got to remember which way. Okay, so the first thing that we need to do, and I'll go through these fairly quickly, is building physical security to halt this cycle of violence. So the sort of things we need are a ceasefire, as in Kashmir, a truce. I can go into these in more detail, any of them that you're interested in. Peacekeeping, the UN peacekeeping forces. Disarmament, as between the US and Russia. Weapons collection, as in El Salvador. Decommissioning of weapons, Northern Ireland. All this left people feeling physically safer. And then disbanding militias. Now, this is possibly the toughest one of all, so I just wanted to go into that in slightly more detail. So you've got the story of Albino Fourcuia in Mozambique. He himself was a child soldier. He fought in the Mozambique Civil War, and he knew that when the amnesty was signed at the end, that many of his former colleagues had gone and buried their weapons, waiting in case they needed them. So what he did was to go along to where he knew the weapons might be buried and offer people bicycles, and then they would tell him where the weapons were, and they were often surrounded by mines, so it was very dangerous work. Dig up the weapons, roll over them with bulldozers so they were out of action, or burn them, and then make the remains into sculptures. And that chair now sits in the UN. So this guy is one of my heroes, Albino. And here's another of my heroes. That's meant to be Democratic Republic of Congo, not Dr. Congo. And one of our partners at Peace Direct has done the following. I'll just run through them quickly in case you're not inclined to read. They've helped 16,000 this is a grassroots initiative, one grassroots initiative, helped 16,000 people who've been displaced to get home again. Persuaded over 4,000 combatants, including 1,000 child soldiers, to leave the bush and return to civilian life. Now I'll just digress there and tell you how this guy does it. His name's Henri Bourra-Ladi, and when we are able to send him a small amount of money, I think the most we've ever sent him at one time was $5,000, he would take, say, $500 of that and go into the bush and buy herds of goats. And he would then drive the goats to where he knew the militia were hiding in the bush. And that in itself was taking his life in his hands, because they're very high on drugs and they're very trigger happy. They don't care who they've killed so many people, they don't care who they kill. So he had to know what he was doing, having also been a child soldier himself. And so he would find his way very carefully to where the militia were, bringing the goats, and these guys were hungry, and he would exchange one goat for one child and bring the children home. And a goat cost $5. And that's how he did it. And then the difficult part began, of course, because to reintegrate children, young men mostly, also young women, who have been induced to fire on their own villages, kill their own parents in some cases, under drugs and coercion, and then rehabilitate them, is a nightmare, as you can imagine. It's a nightmare for them. And so what he's done is found ways in which people being reintegrated can show the community that they're useful. And the last one to read here is that he's got contracts to rebuild roads in the area, and so the young men can work on these roads. They have to work there for 3 years for a very small amount of money, but then the community can see them doing it and realise that they're serious about coming back to village life. And it really, it chokes me up to hear about this kind of painstaking work happening as a result of people just being kidnapped. The young women who've been made into sex slaves have to be equally carefully counselled for the trauma they've been through. And the main thing is to create employment for people, because the main lure to go into the militia is people haven't got jobs. And so he's done a lot of work in setting up agricultural cooperatives and where former fighters and people from the community can work together. So that just takes you into some of the underground detail of what's happening behind these examples I'm giving you. So the next one we'll go on to is how we rebuild political security. And again, starting with some examples, the mediated negotiations at Camp David. I'd just like to refer to the difference between mediation and negotiation. What would you say it was? Anybody? Well, negotiation is when you're going into a set of talks, but on your shoulders you've got sitting your constituency. You're there on behalf of your government or your interest group or whatever it is. So you have to come out of that negotiation with an outcome that's favourable to them. Whereas if you're a mediator, you're not acting on behalf of either. You're looking for the mutual interest. In other words, you're enabling the parties in dispute to move from I'm right and you're wrong, total opposition, this is my position, I'm not budging, and that's your position, you're not budging, to move from that round to where they can stand together and look at the problem and discover, often painfully, if there is a mutual interest. So you're looking to move to mutual interest. So then obviously the peace agreement, which was finally agreed in Kenya after the 2008 riots, which killed over 1,000 people, and Kofi Annan came in and built an agreement between the two protagonists who'd both been bribing young men to go out and kill people. And I'll talk more about that incident in a moment, why he was able to build that agreement. Policing is obviously vitally important. You remember in the Balkans War, a lot of policing needed to be reset up in order to bring community safety. A legal system. In South Africa, they did the most remarkable experiment. After Mandela came out of jail, and in that very dodgy period between 1990 and the elections in 1994, they needed a way to try and keep people from killing each other, not just black on white, but black on black and coloured, so-called on black and so forth. And Mandela knew full well that there would be loads of scores to be settled, and that was the time when it would happen. So what they did was to set up a national peace council and then peace councils at every level, regional, city, town and village. And in those peace councils, they appointed people who had experience like people in this room, people who knew about the psychological motivation to settle scores, people who knew how to help with that, people who were magistrates who knew about the law, people who were sports personalities who were respected in the community, people, particularly women's leaders and women's groups, who were exceptionally good at running these peace councils, chairing them and so forth. And although there were deaths and there were some very nasty incidences of necklacing and so forth, these people who were trained to walk into violence when it was about to break out were unbelievably successful. And now, very sadly, they've disbanded those peace councils. But that was the most remarkable system that they set up. I've put it there as legal system. I should call it as a peace council system. Free elections, you remember what needed to happen in Serbia. Press freedom. Now, Israel is remarkable for many extraordinarily bad governmental decisions, but one of the things that Israel more or less maintains is a free press. And the right to demonstrate, obviously, in Northern Ireland. That's been exceptionally important, but also exceptionally difficult to police. I'm thinking particularly of the marches. So now we'll go on to the third area, building psychological security. And this is where I'm sure it gets more interesting for you. The truth and reconciliation process in South Africa. Is everybody familiar with that? If I may, I'll just digress. Are we doing for time? Yeah. I can digress to just tell you a story on that. As you know, it was set up as an alternative to court process to punish people for the horrific things that they'd done. I lived in South Africa for 10 years, so I remember very clearly the incidents that had happened that even I knew about. But I was there in Cape Town in 1998 and took my daughter along to a hearing of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And there was a young man who was being cross-questioned who had been a black, what's called an askari, a black policeman, but he'd been turned by the white security police boss, the Bureau of State Security. And he had informed on six of his former colleagues in the ANC, the African National Congress. And they were then shot in a cold blood ambush, all shot dead. So here was this young policeman sitting next to the white Bureau of State Security policeman, and the mothers and wives of the men whose deaths he'd caused sitting right there next to him. And at the end of 3 days questioning, he was asked if there was anything he'd like to say. And he said, yes, I regret what I did. And one very astute commissioner said, is there anything else you'd like to say? And he stood for a long time in silence. And then he said, yes, there is. I'm willing to go into a room alone with the mothers of each of the men that whose deaths I caused and hear what they have to say to me. And I get goosebumps even when I tell the story now. The whole room went like this. And people ran out of the room crying. The mothers were sobbing. And everybody knew that energetically something had changed in that room. What I think would be called the field. The field had changed. And transformation had happened. And in my way of thinking, what we're looking for in working with conflict, because there's nothing wrong with conflict, conflicts can be very creative. And all the people who work totally on prevention and conflict resolution, I think need to go one step further, which is the transformation of the energy of conflict. And that TRC, to my way of thinking, was a brilliant example, mainly on Desmond Tutu's part, to have that happen and see it continuing to happen. Because that's when change happens. So, also in terms of building psychological security, you need guarantees. There's something called the no first use of nuclear weapons that Britain has always refused to join in with. But China, and I think Russia, have said that they will never use nuclear weapons first. And if we could get a global agreement on that, even now, it would greatly add to our security. The German and French post-World War II dialogues that took place at the castle in Switzerland called Caux, amazing discussions that actually formed the basis of the eventual European Union. But those discussions between the German and French, held in a very safe environment and very carefully organised, were key for that. Then cross-boundary operations, all these operations that we know about now called sans frontières, Médecins sans frontières, Scientists Without Borders, and so forth. These are all enormously important in linking up professionals on different sides of borders, enabling them to work together for a common good, so that professional people like us in this room can find a way of becoming useful in a conflict, whether you're an engineer, a doctor, a psychologist, whatever. Trust building that was so crucial in Croatia to enable people to reconcile with those who'd ethnically cleansed them. Trauma counselling in Bosnia, that's been a huge endeavour, and I think there are people in this room who've been involved with it. But it was initially found quite problematic with people coming from, say, England to, in quotes, show Bosnians how to do it. But now it works, I think, extremely well, and there's still lots more to do. But that's been, I think, a very profound experience for many counsellors to go and help with that. Deep listening in Rwanda after the genocide, to heal those unbelievably deep wounds left by the genocide through a process of deep listening. And then respect. Now, in all the conflicts that I've analysed, the one thing that leaps out is that one of the main drivers of conflict is humiliation. Humiliation in every different way you can possibly imagine. And the antidote, or one of the best antidotes to humiliation, is respect. And there was an incredible example of that in the middle of the invasion of Iraq. And here I feel happy to say one very positive thing about the American forces in Iraq. They did many terrible things, but this was one very enlightened colonel, Chris Hughes, who was leading his patrol on foot through the streets of Najaf. This was 2 months after the invasion, when you still could have a foot patrol. And here he was with 19 of his young soldiers, heavily, heavily armed, with huge backpacks, massive weapons, body armor, the whole thing, not speaking Arabic. And they were going down a street, and all of a sudden, people started pouring out of the houses on either side of the road, screaming, yelling, and with their fists in the air. And these young soldiers had no idea what the problem was and what was going on. And these people, local people, were so angry that it was basically a lynching in the making. And Chris Hughes saw what was happening, strode into the middle of the whole group with his weapon above his head, pointed at the ground, and said, commanded his men, kneel. They'd never had that command in their lives. And they wobbled precariously to the ground and put their barrels of their weapons into the sand. And complete silence fell. The people of Najaf could not believe that they were seeing these mighty American soldiers, so well armed, who could have killed them all, kneeling. After 5 minutes complete quiet, everybody went home. So we see how one, in the moment, that colonel must have been so present to know in the instant, literally in a fraction of a second, what to do. And it shows me the value of being present all the time in the work that we do, and why meditation and other disciplines for being present in the moment are so vital when it comes to the sharp end of conflict, even if it's you're walking down the street and a fight breaks out. How present can you be to be able to walk into the middle of that fight with sufficient presence that you have, and having dealt with your own fear, that you will be able to calm things rather than make them worse? So now I'm going to... Am I going too fast?
No.
Okay. By the way, as Tony said, do feel free to interrupt. If you've got a burning question, do just raise your hand and I'd like to deal with it when it comes up and recognise what's going on in the room as well. So do tell me if you've got questions. Don't see any at the moment. So now, this is the one that probably fascinates me almost as much as the previous one. Because what I spent a long time working with Mr. Mandela and also reading about his experiences in jail. And the more I read about it, the more fascinated I was by the difference in this man from when he went into jail after the Rivonia trial, way back in 1963, when he was the world's number one terrorist. Everybody was terrified of this man, Mandela. He believed in the use of force, in the use of violence, for enabling, for revolution, basically. He didn't believe in killing individuals. He believed in blowing up power stations. If there was somebody who got killed, well, it had to be. But he was known as a very violent man. And over the years, 27 years in jail, he learned how to deal with brutality without using force in return. And he learned it to such an extent that, I'll just give you one example. I'll give you two. When he stepped off the boat, when the boat bringing him from Cape Town to Robben Island, and this was life imprisonment, and they meant life, so he wasn't going anywhere else from there. When he stepped off the boat, the warders came down with their shumboks, the leather whips, and started cracking them at the prisoners and saying, run, in Afrikaans, obviously, run to your cell. You know, you want to be in your cells, run. And Mandela, quite quietly, he was a chief's son, bear in mind, and he had tremendous courage, always has had. And he walked to the front of the line of prisoners and stood at the front of the line of prisoners and started to walk extremely slowly. And the guards just did not know what to do with this man, partly because of his courage, because of his presence. He shocked them because he wasn't prepared to act like a prisoner, but equally he wasn't prepared to take brutality. And it was that, the condition of the man, the consciousness of the man, that enabled him to set that example, which rippled through how people then learned to behave. But quite further into his imprisonment, he asked for a patch of ground to grow vegetables, because he was a gardener. And also, all the prisoners were very hungry and totally starved of anything fresh. And for years, his requests for ground were denied, and then eventually, after I think 9 requests, he was given a strip of ground probably about the length of this room and a meter wide, and it was full of rocks and sand, and everybody said, you'll never grow anything there. No, not Mandela. He composted anything he could find, weeds and so forth. He began to mulch the soil. He got all the rocks out of it. Somebody, I don't know who, gave him some seeds, and he grew his first crop, and it was, as I remember it, courgettes, tomatoes and beans. And the prisoners were all watching these vegetables ripening with huge eyes. And what did Mandela do when the vegetables were ripe? He gave the first crop to the warders. Now, that was the beginning of the use of compassion by Mandela. He developed compassion for those warders to such an extent that as he and his colleagues helped all the black prisoners become educated, they used to teach each other at the rock face in the quarry where they were working. They would teach, if one of them knew maths, they would teach maths. If one of them knew literature, they'd teach literature. So in the end, they were all, when regulations were relaxed, they were doing long distance degrees at the equivalent of the Open University. And the warders were kind of peering over their shoulders, and many of the warders were semi-illiterate. So the prisoners started teaching the warders to read and write. It was amazing what they did. So I mention all this because that training, you know, if we think 6 years in analysis is long, 27 years on Robben Island is a hell of a training. In self-knowledge, in developing our ability to not be manipulated by our ego, but to be in compassion, to be with the other, to be able to step into the shoes of the other. And of course, when Mandela came out of jail, the first thing he was faced with when he started to begin to negotiate with the apartheid government was huge opposition from the African National Congress, who said, the hell with negotiation, we're going to get those guys now because we can get arms and we can just shoot our way out of here. And Mandela said, no, we have to negotiate. And so he had to bring his own colleagues, mainly the people who hadn't been in jail, who'd been in exile, he had to bring them on side in order to conduct the negotiations and make them work. So that's compassion training, if ever there was. Envisioning the future, there's a marvelous organization called One Voice in Israel-Palestine, which is bringing together young people from both sides to imagine how their future could be. Because as my mentor Joseph Rotblat said, the future belongs to those who can see it. Interfaith dialogue at Coventry Cathedral, many of you probably know about that. Meditation and vigils. There's now a growing community of people worldwide who find that they can, by meditating together with colleagues the other side of the world at the same time, they can build what they call a unified field. And there's one example of that I'd love to give you, which is quite recent. I work with a young spiritual teacher in Germany called Thomas Hubel. He's a bit of the Eckhart Tolle mold, if you like. And Thomas conducts a festival every year at the end of July and does very large group meditations, probably 600, 700, 800 people at a time. And he has taken any of those people he engages with there, invited them to come and meditate at Hitler's bunker. Because Thomas reckons that a lot of the wounds of the Second World War in Germany have not yet been healed. And so they go and meditate at Hitler's bunker for, say, 2 hours, and then they hum together. It's beautiful. I've done it with them. And the humming starts to be like a flock of birds circulating in the room, and then people open their mouths and actually sing together for 20 minutes, half an hour at a time. It's extraordinarily powerful. And so Thomas then said, because he's married to an Israeli, let's go and do this in Israel. And so he asked an Israeli Jewish organization if they would assemble people in a room. So they assembled 60 people and he brought 60 people. I was there and they paired up one with one. And most of the German people had parents or grandparents who'd been Nazis, and most of the Israelis had parents or grandparents who'd been in the camps. So you had these one-to-one encounters going on. And within 5 minutes, I think everyone in the room was in tears. And what happened in those meetings was a transformation of a very, very old wound. Obviously not complete, but the beginning of that transformation. So that's really what I'm talking about, the symbolic actions, the toning in Berlin. And there's a huge amount of work in Northern Ireland that many of you may know about on forgiveness. Then there's the Ho'oponopono in Hawaii. Does anybody know about that? Okay, I think we've got time to tell you about it. Are these stories useful?
Yes.
Okay. Ho'oponopono is a very ancient tradition in Hawaii. And it basically runs like this, that whatever the issue, that if somebody has done something to me, I must say four things to them, either directly or in my mind. Please forgive me. I love you. No, please forgive me. Thank you. I love you. I've forgotten what the fourth is. There is a fourth one. It'll come back. Anyway, there's a doctor. I love you. Maybe. There's a Dr. Hugh Len, H-E-W-L-E-N, if you want to look him up, who was put in charge of a psychiatric ward in the main hospital in Hawaii. And it was a ward for the criminally insane. And there were such problems on this ward, such violence, that a lot of the staff were giving up and couldn't come to work or resigned or were going absent on leave. And so they asked Dr. Hewland if he would take over the running of this ward. And what he did, apparently, and it's been totally verified, is he didn't go and talk to the patients. He took the files of every patient home and worked on them consistently with these phrases that I've just said. Now, when you tell this story, you think, what? But what the Ho'oponopono methodology is based on is that everything that comes into my orbit as a human being, I'm responsible for. So if you, as a criminally insane patient, are put in front of me, then what I must do is say, I'm sorry, please forgive me. I know what it is. I'm sorry, please forgive me. I love you. Thank you. That's how it works. And you must keep on doing that. And I've tried it. And I was working on the World Peace Festival in Berlin, and I had the very unfortunate experience of working with someone who basically spent a lot of money and didn't account for it and didn't pay a lot of the people who were working with me. And it was very, very sore experience, and I was extremely angry with this man and vengeful, and I didn't quite make a clay doll and stick pins into it, but nearly. And this feeling of it lasted several weeks after I came back from Berlin. And I was going along in my car, and the thoughts were coming up, and I thought, well, I better do Ho'oponopono. So I did it many times, driving my car from Oxford to where I live. And my phone doesn't work in the valley where I live, but it works at the top of the hill. And as I turned off the main A40 to drive down to my village, my phone rang, and it was this guy. And he said, I just want to say I'm sorry. Out of the blue like that. So it works. And the last one is prayer. And so there are so many different versions of that taking place everywhere. So I'll just move on now and say that for me, these spiritually based initiatives, they're sort of spiritual psychological, if you like, are important because they go to the root of the problem of violence. They address the deepest pain. They light up the deepest longing in human beings, which is, I think, for connection and contribution. And they're based in the knowledge that we're all ultimately part of the same whole. They're also the most sustained of the peace initiatives that I come across. And they're sustainable. So they're working at grassroots level from the bottom up. And having worked with, as Tony described, nuclear weapons policymakers at the, if you like, the highest level, I'm now much more interested, or as interested, in the people who work from the bottom up. And I'll tell you why. So although they might be impossible for a PhD student to measure, and they're difficult to evaluate, and they're probably difficult to cost as well, but they seem to allow those doing them access to unimaginable power. I think I'll pause there for a moment, and just so that we can catch our breath a little bit, and ask you if you would like to turn to your neighbour and just spend 3 or 4 minutes each just talking about any experiences you've had along these lines. Because I'm always interested in, I'm not going to ask you all to say them afterwards, but maybe at lunchtime, if you've had specific experiences of this kind of thing happening, I'm always interested to know, whether it's on the personal level or on a community level or whatever. So would you like to do that, to turn to your neighbour and just talk for a little while about your own experiences of conflict being transformed at a psychological or spiritual level, that the one that most rings in your mind at the moment? So I will ting the glass when it's time to change over. So about 4 minutes. Please change over if you haven't already. Please come to a close now. And please do continue those conversations over lunch if you want to, because I'm always fascinated to hear people's experience. For now, what I want to do is... Ooh! Where did that come from? Back in business. I want to try and pull this together a bit, because we've ranged over a great many different possible experiences. What have I done now? What have I done? Well, it doesn't matter, because I can just go on and tell you what it was going to say. And that is that... We're back. Now let me see if I can not spoil it this time. No, that's back. That's forward. There. When I come across something like this, like a growing incidence, or so it appears to me, of a particular type of peace building, I'm always interested in whether that is a true reflection or whether it's just my own perception. When I decided to hand Oxford Research Group onto other extremely competent people, and I became really interested in the phenomenon of what you might call grassroots, bottom-up peace building, I decided to do a survey and see just how much of this was going on, because it seemed to me there was quite a lot. So I engaged a wonderful young researcher called Dylan Matthews, and he had come originally from Sri Lanka, and he did a survey of all the then sort of 30-odd conflict areas in the world to find out who was doing what in what way, and to get an idea of their effectiveness. And he was able to identify about 350 such grassroots initiatives which were reliable and were being effective. And we took 50 of them and wrote them up as case studies in a book that was called War Prevention Works, How Ordinary People Are Building Peace. If we were to do the same exercise today, now that Peace Direct has been established and has a much better grasp, a much better set of indicators of what's happening, there would be at least five times that many. So in 13 years, there's been, I estimate, I can't be absolutely accurate, but about a fivefold increase in what people are doing, taking peace into their own hands. And that's everything from building bridges, from decommissioning weapons, from releasing child soldiers, as we've seen, to organising across borders, organising across communities. All the slow, unglamorous, definitely unsung work of steady building of peace, or, as many people will realise, the laborious work of healing trauma. And a colleague, Paul Hawken, is a fabulous innovator in the world of researching what's actually happening worldwide. And he has described in a wonderful book called Blessed Unrest, you know it, this worldwide movement that really hasn't been noticed yet by the media or the politicians. And he's spent a decade researching organisations devoted in one way or another to social justice. That includes environmental, health, education, agriculture, all sorts of areas that people become active in, reclaiming or fighting for land that is being acquired by multinational corporations, and so forth. So he says these organisations collectively comprise the largest movement on earth. It's organising from the bottom up, and it's emerging as an extraordinary and creative expression of people's needs worldwide. And if you watch his TED talk, I think it's a TED talk, anyway, it's on YouTube. If you just Google him, Paul Hawken, you will see him standing there giving a talk like this for an hour, and behind him is unrolling on the screen. It's a black screen with white writing, and each item is the name of a civil society organisation somewhere in the world. And he says at the end of his talk, you've seen now about 5% of the, after a year, an hour of this thing rolling, of the number of organisations that there are in the world. So this phenomenon, due to all sorts of reasons, but I've yet to really understand it, this phenomenon of people organising, and Bristol's famous for this, that people in Bristol have, more than almost any other city in the country, started to take civic affairs, educational affairs, environmental affairs into their own hands and do something about it. And find ways of funding it, find ways of making it, of evaluating whether what they're doing is effective or not, because all these things are absolutely vital if you want to continue to engage public support or engage funding support. So it's got no name, no leader, location, but it's growing fast all over the world. So I told you about that. And every time we look, there's more. We've got a website which I'll show you in a minute. Well, I'll come to it. So these initiatives are small scale. Very often, they're only working with a team of two or three people. For example, in Nepal, There's a group that have been working to build peace between the Maoists and the local people who want to support a legitimately elected government. And they've been phenomenally successful. And they're just little cells of them, sort of three people by three people by three people, but working almost all over the country. So compared to the power of the UN peacekeeping force, these things are tiny. Very few of them have got the ability to stop a full-blown war. And I would say that now they're more and more coordinated across countries or regions, because what Peace Direct and other organisations do is have what we call a peace exchange. We've just had one in Rwanda. No, not in Rwanda, sorry, in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, where we brought in the peace builders that we work with from Pakistan, Sri Lanka, India, Kenya, Colombia, Rwanda, Burundi, South Africa, Zimbabwe, and some from Northern Ireland and some from Bosnia, to meet together and exchange their techniques, their anxieties, their worries, their need for nourishment, and just being with other people who are facing the same knife-edge problems, they find enormously enriching, as you would imagine. But these people are all ahead of the game. Why? Now, this is where I mentioned the violence that broke out after the previous set of elections in Kenya, 2007-2008. And I'll just tell you the story informally, never mind the PowerPoint. My friend Deka Ibrahim Abdi, who's a Muslim woman from northeastern Kenya, who had found out how to build peace between two warring clans who were slaughtering each other over cattle rustling. And she learned how to do that by actually working with the women from the other clan and developing a peace plan and then taking it to the elders, who initially dismissed them and said, "You know nothing about war." And they said, "Yes, we know something about war. We want to build peace." And they managed to persuade the clan elders to adopt their plan. And then she became known all over Kenya and developed people, sort of a network of people she knew or had trained almost in every town in the country. And so when this violence broke out on the very last day of 2007, she got a call at her home in Mombasa: "Get on a plane, Deka, come to Nairobi to the Serena Hotel, room 217. So she did. She walked in and there was a circle of chairs. There were two Kenyan generals, two diplomats, and two civil society leaders, and one vacant chair. And they said, "That's your chair, Deka. You're the chair of this group. We have to stop the violence." And they did the most amazing thing. They got hold of the main women's organization in Kenya that had 60,000 members, most of whom had cell phones. And they said, "Please look outside your window and text us what's happening." And then they put flip chart up all around the walls of the hotel room, and they mapped the hot spots of the conflict where people were killing each other, burning churches, as you remember, in Eldoret. And they mapped also the cold spots where people were running to for safety. And then Deka got on the phone to the people she knew in all those areas and said, "Listen, you have quickly to pull together your magistrates, your school heads, your religious heads, your women's organizations, your sports personalities, anybody who's trustworthy in the community, and you need to build a peace plan for, and you need to do that tonight." And then what they did was they went out with loudhailers all round the towns and told everybody what the peace plan was. Within 2 weeks, by this methodology, they had managed to bring the violence down sufficiently that when Kofi Annan turned up to bang the heads together of the two very corrupt leaders who were paying people to kill each other, he was able to get something that could stick, because they had been working at the grassroots level. And that was the story that wasn't told. So the intelligence they were getting by using ordinary people and cell phones was actually 24 hours ahead of what the Kenyan government knew. So that's what they did. And as a result of this, a very bright young Kenyan IT engineer came along and said, "This is fascinating what you did. I'm going to build an IT platform." So she built one, and it's called Ushahidi, and it's now used in disaster relief and riots and all sorts of places where people are in panic. And what it is the way I, as a non-techie, understand it, is that they developed this platform which has a number on it. And if you've got your cell phone with you and you're buried in the rubble in Haiti and you want to be dug out or you need water or whatever, you text to that number where you are and what you need. And that platform coordinates all these needs, so that instead of sending an ambulance out to one area and then to another, they can send an ambulance and pick up three people instead of one at a time, and so forth. So it helps to coordinate the whole emergency relief effort. And then there's this wonderful free software called Frontline SMS. So the whole thing can be done on the web to coordinate relief. So I don't know if you can you read it from the back of the room? The web administrator can decide to send a text message back to the sender to verify the information so it's not a hoax, and send out a blast alert to large numbers of people who can help, or post the information on a web page with the location information from Google Maps. So it's a brilliant assembling of technology. And that came out of this community initiative. So in Burma, as we know, citizens at great risk photographed police attacks on monks. These photos appeared almost immediately on media around the world so that the military junta couldn't keep it secret, showing the extent of what was happening to the monks. And then the Burmese government could no longer deny it. In Afghanistan, an NGO actually started by Peter Gabriel, the singer. He supplied women with video cameras, and they held them in the pockets of their burqas, which were covered with a sort of a grill of embroidery. So the films they made, you've got this grill work, but through it you can see people being beaten up in the street. And they were able to send the information out of the country so that the footage could be used to mount human rights campaigns. And women actually have been prominent in, I would say, the majority of the initiatives that we've mapped. Not only my own organisation, Peace Direct, but Search for Common Ground, who are wonderful. They're based in the United States, but they've got offices all over the world. International Alert, also very big. Conciliation Resources, based in London, and many other NGOs. And I just want to come now to the cost aspect of this, because the civil society initiatives in Kenya cost less than $200,000. That's what it cost to bring the violence almost to a standstill. So they helped save thousands of lives and helped Kenya becoming another Somalia, which is now, I don't know if you noticed, but the last elections in Kenya earlier this year passed off peacefully because of this network. So that initiative I told you in Mozambique collected 800,000 weapons. But the cost of the UN mission to disarm and demobilize 200,000, so a quarter, was 493 million, whereas former CRES 10-year program cost 6 million. So what small people can do with comparatively small, well, that's a big amount of money compared to what most of our organisations do. We didn't give them 6 million, I promise you. We'd never seen 6 million. But they managed to raise it after we made clear, made known what they were doing. That's one of the things that Peace Direct does. It brings media coverage to these initiatives so that they get known, and that makes the people safer, and it also enables them to apply for money from people who've got much more money than we have. So now is the time, I reckon, for the world to invest in these incredible civilians. The last time I did the research, which was about 4 years ago, governments spend 1,885 times as much on the military, that's personnel, equipment and training, as they do on the prevention of conflict generally. And almost nothing on supporting civilians to stop violence. So for every $1 spent internationally on prevention of conflict, 1,885 is spent on a militarized approach. So we support them directly ourselves, and we can support and persuade our politicians to invest in them. DFID is beginning to get the picture, and I've got a pamphlet here that Peace Direct put out showing the value of local initiatives, and it's one of the ones that we use to persuade governments to invest in this. What governments say is funding a small initiative that needs $10,000 a year or $20,000 a year is messy. And they're frightened of doing it because if one of them goes wrong and it gets into the Daily Mail, they get hamstrung for it. So we say, well, then in that case, just give larger amounts to organisations like the ones I've just named and let us do the messy business, and you can just give us a chunk of money. And they're beginning to get that, but a bit slow. Our total budget in Peace Direct this year is still under £1 million. So that's Peace Direct. So we've documented these peace-building initiatives in each of 15 areas of hot conflict. And if you wanted to see the maps that we've drawn up of those initiatives, they're on a website called Insight on Conflict. And there's lots of leaflets here that tell you how to find those websites. And so there's also information on making peace at home. Peace Direct supports a number of local initiatives, notably one in southeast London, where young people are who have been in knife or gun gangs, in Newham particularly, where the Olympics were held. They've developed a method using theatre to engage other young people in how to stop street fights and how to get people out of knife and gun gangs. And that the method they've perfected is now being copied in other cities where there's a lot of gang violence. So as we know, we all experience conflict and we've all overreacted or behaved in a way we later regretted and wished we could make redress for. And we got a program called Make Your Peace for all of us to work on. So that's the website for that. And as I said at the beginning, all the methods that we've described don't only apply in a hot conflict area. They apply in hot conflicts in our own living rooms. And the key role of local people like ourselves in achieving durable peace, and illustrate the variety of initiatives that have been used. The imagination of people is just amazing. So showing how the cycle of violence can be reversed, turned around on these different levels. And this is the very last bit. I've always wondered how this is all fitting together worldwide. Is the world actually becoming more conscious? Are we connecting up with each other more? Is there a phenomenon happening? Is there a kind of mushrooms through concrete phenomenon taking place. And so I like this metaphor. You know that scientists call the cells in a caterpillar that emerge, they call them imaginal cells, because they're containing the blueprint of a whole new being. And initially, those imaginal cells are attacked by the caterpillar's original cells. But gradually, as more appear, they begin to cluster together to form the first organs of the new creature. And the old form literally dies as the butterfly is born. And Michael White says that this is what's happening to humanity. I'll read it in case it's too dim at the back. Every person who carries universal peace in their hearts represents an imaginal cell. In every nation, there are groups of these cells that have begun to cluster together to form an organ of peace. And I love that. Do you know what that is? It's a crop circle. Yeah. So that's where I shall pause and open the floor to your questions.
That was fantastic. Thank you very much. I wanted to say something about lack of power, because that seems to me to be behind a lot of the conflicts that we are aware of. And I can see how the cycle that you have described takes place, and I can see how the steps that you've described can make a huge difference. But if there is no shift in power relations between groups, isn't conflict going to recur, no matter how well-intentioned the individuals are who may go through a mediation process?
That's absolutely accurate question to pose on this issue. And, you know, when you have a situation like, say, the military government in Burma, and you see how many people just who were protesting peacefully simply get slaughtered, that is the question that comes into focus. What do you do with extreme violence? Whether it's an individual in the home or whether it's a government. And what Aung San Suu Kyi says is it's a question of perseverance and not giving up hope and inner work. I don't know if you know, she was in house arrest for 15 years, on and off, not all the time. And there was one time where she wasn't in house arrest, and she was leading a group of protesters down the street. And they came around a corner, and I think there were about 1,000 students following her. She came around a corner, and they were faced with a phalanx of machine guns. And she realized instantly that the fingers shivering on the trigger of the young soldiers were just as frightened as the students were now behind her. So she said to the students, sit down, because she knew that fear was going to cause bloodshed. And because she had learned to deal with her own fear, she was 2 when her father died. He was a big general in Burma, as you know. But she learned from his, what he taught her mother and so forth, she learned to face and go right into her own fear. So she was able to walk forward to the guns in a very calm manner. I mean, you saw photos of her when she came to UK earlier this year, wasn't it? And she's tiny. She's got this dignity. And what seems like innocence, it isn't, but it's just this wonderfully fine calmness. And even when she heard the order given, release safety catches, prepare to fire, she still walked on until she could put her hand out on the barrel of the first gun and lower it. Now, there was one individual faced with all these machine guns, responsibility for a whole lot of people behind her, and the presence, I can only call it that, to act in the right way, from the right place. Now, what she says is that although constantly the protests were knocked back, people were locked up, tortured in the most horrific ways, she says that meditation and self-inspection every day in her house arrest was what kept her going and gave her that immediate presence to act as she did. So it is to do with the quality of the opposition, the manner of the opposition. I used to be very confrontational because I was so angry about nuclear weapons, and I read up so much about what's coming out in the papers now about 30. Well, there, one nuclear weapon being lost was reported this week. Apparently, I was in India, but apparently it was, and everybody said, "Oh, what? They lost a nuclear." 32 nuclear weapons have been lost without trace. Nobody knows where they are. 32. So, and I was incensed by the dangers that we were being exposed to. This was in the early 80s. And when I first came into contact with those responsible for the decisions, I was so angry. And it was, you know, I was furious with them, and they could feel it, so no dialogue ensued, because you're not going to have dialogue with somebody who's accusing you outright and furious. So I had to learn to deal with my own fury, really. And that took a while. But I realized it was actually my business to divorce the person from the action. So I could be furious about the action and talk to the person as a human being who had troublesome teenagers or ingrown toenails or whatever, just like me. I haven't got ingrown toenails, actually. But I have lots of other things wrong with me. So that was... I don't know if that answers your question. Does it?
Thinking about it.
Thinking about it. Well, we can go further into that this afternoon. Anybody else? Yes.
Hello, I'm Carol Brooks. Mm-hmm. I'm just mind blown by your lecture. I feel quite shaky standing up here talking. I'm wondering how you can stop the cycle regenerating in the next generation, partly to do with what Ruth said about the lack of power that they have, but also that they're carrying the energy, maybe the hate, the knowledge of the violence inside them that actually is not theirs, but was the generations before. Because Kenya was a repeat of what had happened 30 years ago. What's happening in Syria may well be the result of what happened before, when the Western powers decided to segregate Syria into different areas, and it was never thought about how people were going to live together within that.
Exactly.
So it's
a totally right question. I think the only suggestion I can make is that the opportunity for people to address the depth of the trauma that they've been through or that their parents went through, and being willing to walk towards the darkness. Because what most of us do when there's been that extent of trauma is we try and bury it. A great friend of mine's father was in Auschwitz, and he never spoke about it. And I think many, many people who went through that experience have blocked it. It was just too bad, too horrific. But now, aged 90, his dad is actually talking about it. I don't know what changed that He was able to. But my feeling is, and you all, I'm sure, have experience of this, that the more we're willing to have the courage to sit with extreme pain, extreme grief, torture, whatever it is, and just allow it to change within us, we don't really have to do anything as long as we're prepared to sit in the heat of it. I see it as like sitting in a crucible, in a process of alchemy, that if we're willing to sit those emotions in that heat of a crucible, they change themselves. And so we're not any longer driven by them. But that's not something that's available to a lot of people. They don't know it. So I feel we've got a huge teaching job to do, especially to young people, to equip them with those skills of really being willing to go inside, to stop the speed that they live at and go into whatever is lying underneath. What do you think?
I think sometimes it's an unconscious thing that they're carrying, not a conscious thing, and you have to get it up to consciousness before you can do anything.
Yeah, I'm sure you're right. I'm sure you're right. So enabling people to realise that there is often something completely hidden that's driving them. Yeah. Thank you.
Hi, my name's Roberta, and I've been really impressed by this morning's talk. And I'm just thinking about the concept of creative indifference, and I don't know if you've come across that before, and I'm sure there's people better able to talk about it here. But it seems to me that the risky endeavour is in not trying to control the other person, in making yourself vulnerable and handing over what they're going to do with that. That seems to be the powerful response, is actually not to have all the weapons, but to kneel down. Yeah. Not to point the gun, but to lower it. So this, I don't know if anyone wants to add to that, but that's what I'm thinking of at the moment.
And the name for that is creative indifference?
Yeah, well, that's what I'm thinking of
at
the moment.
That's very interesting, yeah. I think that's, in a nutshell, I think that's absolutely it. Now, hang on to the microphone for a minute, because I'm sure you've got more to say on this. I'd like to hear from you. What else do you feel?
I think at the moment that's my sense. Is to be as open and transparent as I can with myself and with other people.
Yes.
And not to try and control what they do with it.
Yes.
Those are the two things.
Yes. Exactly.
And it's worked over the last few years.
Right. Thank you.
But it's how to stay creatively indifferent, because I have passion and I have drive and I often think I'm right and I think I know what I want to happen at the other end of things. And if only they do this, this and this. So it's somehow how to stay in that place, because it's a process. It's a continual process. At any minute, I can become the vengeful person after being so kind and generous, actually. It's just like, so it's how to almost be willing for the outcome that I don't want to happen to happen, and to be okay with that, even though I'm not really, if you see what I mean. I think
absolutely.
That's what it is.
Absolutely, you're on it. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Brilliant.
Hello, I'm Tara Jaffer. I'm originally from Iraq, and some of my work is based in Iraq. So I'm interested in referring back to the cycle. I remember you mentioned that it didn't have to be in this order, but I'm interested in how the value of working on the psychological level when the physical security is not there and the trauma is still in sort of the, it's still there.
Oh.
I mean, it's still forming and it's... So there isn't any physical safety. And so sometimes I question... the value or how to kind of begin the work, or is it a case of waiting until things settle, or that seems very passive. Mm. And as I'd like to be creatively indifferent at the same time to begin sowing the seeds if we can, if the soil is ready. Mm.
Do you have relatives in Iraq at the moment?
Not anymore. My father left in 2003. Mm-hmm. And so Iraq, and since 1980, has been in war. Yeah. And with Iran, Iraq, and then various other. And still, it still is. It's not referred to as a civil war, but... And there is an element of the subconscious, I think.
Yes.
Very much. Yeah. People kind of... generations being born of this anger, and in this country as well, in the Iraqi diaspora.
Yeah.
So.
It's almost beyond imagination, the amount of trauma and suffering and grief and anger there must be in Iraq. And it makes me furious that we... succumb to this appalling temptation to go and bomb and make things worse yet again, which we've done in Afghanistan 3 or 4 times. And I just hope that we're now, talking from the British, and that we're now beginning to learn. Just, we'll probably talk about what happened in the House of Commons on the Syria vote, because I think that was something like a turning point. But coming back to Iraq, I mean, I've only been to Iraq once, and that was 2 months before the invasion. And I don't feel that I know the situation there well enough now to say anything sensible. However, I don't, to try and answer your question, I don't think you've got to wait until there is physical security and political security before you can embark on psychological and spiritual. I feel that they can, whichever is your skill, can be applied, and even applied in the diaspora, because you're living, were you born there?
Yes, I was born in Baghdad. I came here when I was 11. And I do work with the Iraqi diaspora. I'm working
you do.
On a project now. Yeah.
I think that's really important. Because the more psychologically awake, conscious people can be in dealing with these huge issues, the more they help they can be to people still in Iraq. But I just, my mind boggles at the extent of what there is to do. And the experience is that when people have suffered as much as that, whether it's humiliation, whether it's physical wounding or psychological wounding, it can take 3 generations before it's worked through, if nothing is done. If there is skill available, then it can happen much faster. And that was the reason for the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which, if I dare say it, if there had been good sense enough to have a Truth and Reconciliation Commission between, it's almost inconceivable, between Sunni and Shia in Iraq. Even while Saddam Hussein was alive, he wouldn't have allowed it, but certainly after he was gone, something different might have come out of it. It's still possible. Still possible.
Oddly enough, the Sunni Shia wasn't so strong under Saddam. But that's something else.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, there's lots of other stuff going
on. Lots of other stuff.
But the numbness stage, that really struck.
Yeah.
That's something I recognized a lot in Iraq and in here, like in this country.
Yeah. I think that's very important.
Thank you. It's a good, very good to hear.
I wish I could say something more useful.
Mark Thomas, that was a fantastic presentation, so thank you. I've got 2 things, but the first really is, I wonder what your take on is this. In the human rights and freedom of expression world, they more or less come up with a kind of an axiom, which is you have the right to be offended, and you have the right to cause offence, And I kind of sign up to it in that I get it that it's about presence and mutuality and looking for a kind of a dialogue. I hurt you and you can be hurt and these are human rights. But often in the writing on people like Ken and Malik and lots of other people write about this stuff, my concern is a little bit, as you were talking about, as in terms of a cycle, how that can lead to a kind of a spiral into humiliation in and of itself, even though the attempt is to do something else. Mm-hmm. And into violence, often you're just talking about...
Sorry?
We were just talking about Sunni, Shiite, Catholic, you know, the various polarized positions. I wonder if you have any thoughts about any of
well,
that.
Well, I want to be sure what your question really is. You talked about the cycle of violence descending into a spiral of humiliation.
Well, I was thinking about how even that statement, which is intended to be helpful and mm-hmm. universal, in itself seems to carry humiliation in it, depending on...
Which statement?
The statement, you have the right to cause offence
right.
or to be offended.
Right.
And that's an easy thing to say intellectually.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then I feel it, and I'm in a different place.
Who says you have the right to cause offence?
Oh, I think it's a commonplace in the freedom of expression world.
I see.
And they write about it a lot. I was thinking of Ken and Malik writing a lot of stuff, but a lot of other people do as well.
Okay.
I wonder if how that connects to anything.
I wonder. I'm very intrigued by the different qualities of listening that go on. As I mean, all of you know a lot about listening. And I've noticed that if people who have very radical and quite crazy views are actually listened to in private, not in public probably, for quite a long time, they get to a point where they can begin to express what it is they need, actually, underneath. The NBC approach, nonviolent communication, that if they're asked to talk in the first person and say what it is they observe and what they're feeling and then what they need, they often eventually come up with a request that can actually be met in some way. I'm not saying this always works, but I've seen it have the most extraordinary results, for instance, between Israelis and Palestinians, where the dialogue is often extremely violent and polarized, and you think nothing can ever build understanding between people from those two sides, because there is so much to accuse. But there is something about a particular type of listening where the listener has no intention to help. The listener is simply giving the speaker their absolute full attention, keeping eye contact, and then waiting for what comes next, but never gives advice. There's something that happens in that process that has been found, for example, in the slums, the favelas of Rio. A young man called Dominic Barter has been working with young men who've been imprisoned for grievous bodily harm, and working with them and the people that they harmed. So it's a cross between, what do you call it? When people work with the perpetrator works with the victim. Restorative justice, thank you. It's a cross between restorative justice with nonviolent communication. So they do it in a group of the community with people observing, so the one can actually listen to the other and eventually get to hear what the feelings are underneath. And he's had the most unbelievable results, where recidivism, people reoffending after they get out of prison, was, I think, 87%. They got it down to 42%, just using that technique. So I can't say it always works, but I'm moved by these. That's why I'm always interested in statistics, actually, not being a very I'm not a very left brain person really, but I do love evidence that can be tested of these things, because people so often dismiss it as wishy-washy, airy-fairy, touchy-feely, but it's powerful. I don't know if that responds. Yes. Oh God.
Let us come in there.
Yeah.
Is that okay? Tony Voss again. Listening to Mark, I was reminded that in this country, for example, we value our freedom of expression so much. And I think with freedom of expression comes some responsibility. So we may have a right to offend, mm-hmm. but maybe we need to understand when we don't need to use it.
Yeah.
And I think things could be a lot calmer sometimes if people were able to recognise that right.
And yeah, to that's quite right.
I hadn't moved a formal thank you to you, Silla, because I know we're only halfway through this experience and this afternoon will be...
Can I just say one small thing?
Yes, do.
If you're wandering around and looking at the bookshelf, they've got copies of this little book called Peace Begins With Me that I've put together to contain a lot of these stories that I've been telling. So it's on sale at the bookstall if you want it.